the Honorable Chief Justice Perry Harvey presiding.
Good morning. Go ahead and be seated. All right, the first matter on our calendar this morning is docket number 53693, Saavedra Sandoval versus Walmart Stores. Are we ready to proceed?
We are.
All right. Let's proceed.
Does the court have any preference on order? Your Honor, Ryan Griffith, Nevada Bar 7362, appearing on behalf of the law offices of Anthony Lopez on behalf of the appellant plaintiff in the underlying case. The briefing paper, the request for oral arguments, this court wanted us to look at the issue of whether or not the defendant had weighed their objections to the imperfect service, is the way to describe it, and how that should play in reflection to the amendments of Rule 4I.
Counsel, excuse me, Chief.
Come on up to the podium. And did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Sure.
How much?
Sure, just a couple of minutes, probably.
Okay. Let's do 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, the briefing request that came from the Supreme Court wanted us to look at the issue of several things. One, had the defendant, Walmart, waived their claim to assert a defect in the service? The other one was the relationship between the Schremer case and the amendments to Rule 4 that were passed in 2004. The issue of whether Schremer should be revisited in the basis of this case, I'm not quite certain why we would want to do that, because the Schremer case dealt specifically with the 120-day issue. The only manner in which the 120-day issue arises in this case is whether or not the underlying court properly or improperly denied the appellant's request for additional time to effect service of process.
Well, that was after the 120 days had already run, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Substantially after.
Yes. And the purpose in doing that in the underlying case was that was when they learned that there was this defect in service, a professional process server making an error that was not caught before the return of service was submitted to the district court. I think that's how that applies in this case. In view of the amendments made to Rule 4I, which deal with the 120-day time limit, those amendments did not, they tend to indicate that it would be best for anyone seeking an extension of time to effect service of process to file a motion for that extension of time prior to the expiration of the 120-day rule.
You say it suggests, doesn't it direct?
Well, it gives some...
It's very specific.
The new Rule 4 says that it's... my view of it is that it should suggest, because it also states that if it's not done, it's one of the factors to be taken in consideration in reviewing a motion for an extension of time to file a service.
Okay.
So in relationship to the Schremer case, that is essentially one of the underlying themes inside the Schremer case. The Schremer case gave the lower courts a series of factors to look at, not completely inclusive, but said these are things the court should look at in making a determination of the good cause requirement that an extension of the 120-day time limit to file or to serve a defendant should be based on. The new Rule 4I makes it pretty clear. You can't just go and grant, a lower court can't just go and grant an automatic extension of 120 days. There has to be some kind of a factual showing of good cause. And that's, I think, is also reflected in Rule 4I when it says that the failure to file that motion for an extension of time is one of the factors the court should also look at in making a good cause determination as to whether an extension of time should be granted.
And in this particular case, what was the good cause?
Well, the good cause was The complaint and the summons was turned over to a professional process server, and then when the service came back, it probably was not reviewed properly. It was processed through and promptly filed with the court.
Counsel, let's go back to that. You're throwing the process server under the bus, so to speak. Weren't instructions given to the process server as to who should have been served?
I believe on the process server's form that was used at that time was summons and complaint, and it was just basically services needed service.
So is that not the responsibility of the attorney asking the service to be performed by this third party?
Arguably, yes. Strong argument, yes. My own personal practice, when I have something served, I give very specific instructions on how I want it served. Unfortunately, I think in this case, this is a long, well-established legal services business, and I think there was reliance on the fact that this legal services business would know what to do when you're dealing with a corporate entity. Apparently not.
Counsel, Mike, I'm over here. My question is this. As I understand your arguments, and I know the judge looked at all these arguments before she made her rulings, but once she made her rulings, we have to review it on whether she abused her discretion after weighing all this. How do you feel she that standard is met, that there's an abuse of discretion?
As far as an abuse of discretion here, I think you have to lay that off against, you know, another one of the great tensions in the legal system. Is there's an overriding concern that we want to decide these cases as much as we can on the merits of the case. And I think in this case, the lower court just basically said, I don't care. We didn't get the 120 days. It wasn't perfect service on the corporate entity. The statute says there has to be perfect service on the corporate entity. I'm just going to dismiss the complaint. There is also some thin reeds of authority issued by this court that when you file for a motion to dismiss, a motion for dismiss, is that a motion to dismiss must also be accompanied with a motion to quash service of the summons. Because you could dismiss a complaint and then you would still effectively have a valid summons floating around out there. So this court kind of gave some direction. I think it was in the Lacey case that was issued in 1993.
Well, didn't we kind of merge those together at some point in time on what type of motion you file? And I can't remember off the top of my head what case it was, but we kind of changed that procedure and how we deal with those types of motions.
There was a case that seems to have brought that issue up in dicta where they... It was following along the line. I don't know if it was a Lacey case or I don't think it was in a Schwimmer case. But they basically, I think the court took the position is that it would be nice to do that, but kind of implied in a motion or inferred in a motion to dismiss is the motion to quash the summons.
Well, this is interesting academically, but you didn't say anything about that in your briefs.
I recognize that.
Oh.
I recognize that. I came across that when I was preparing for this argument.
Did plaintiff object to the motion by the defendant to amend the answer to be able to proceed with the motion to dismiss?
My understanding, they did not object to that.
So we kind of have a whole series of missing the marks with respect to procedural rules, but you still are arguing, I believe, that you want to have an opportunity to reach the merits of the case. Fair statement?
Very fair, and your criticism of the early procedural handling of this case is well noted. Your assessment of that I would describe as very kind and gracious compared to my assessment of those same circumstances when I sat down with Mr. Lopez and reviewed this case.
And so the legal standard upon which we might give you relief would be what in your mind, counsel?
I'm sorry?
Legal standard upon which we might grant you relief would be what?
I'd call it a mercy shot.
The legal standard, I think the strongest one is that we do want to try and decide these cases on the merits. it was a good faith effort made on the part of plaintiff to affect service on the defendant. They unfortunately relied on someone else to do that for them, did not direct that person well in doing that, and did not learn of that error. Perhaps when they should have caught it, they should have perhaps had the burden of reviewing that proof of service to make sure it would be sustainable in court. Did not do that, and the defect in the service was not indicated or came to be realized until sometime later. Yes.
Anything else you want to cover?
I think that pretty much describes our position in regard to the issues that the court wanted us to address in the oral argument.
And you've got some time left. Is there anything beyond what we had asked you to address that you'd like to address?
I don't believe so at this point.
Okay. Well, then you got 5 minutes, a little over 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Justices. Brenda Ensminger for the respondent. This court has two separate independent bases for affirming the district court's dismissal of the underlying action. First, the district court properly dismissed pursuant to its inherent authority under Rule 4I. When Sandoval filed a motion for enlargement of time per Rule 4I, Sandoval herself put the issue before the court. And per Rule 4I's language, the court had the power on its own initiative to dismiss if it did not find good cause. Rule 4I provides that if service is not made within 120 days of the filing of the complaint, the action shall be dismissed.
Why was it in the initial answer? Why didn't Walmart initially answer and say, wait a minute, there's a problem here with 4I?
Your Honor, that goes to the second issue. The district court properly dismissed pursuant to Walmart's motion to dismiss. And the reason why Walmart did not waive its objection is because Walmart's first actual notice of the lawsuit was on October 8th, 2008. That's over a year post-filing of the complaint, and that's over a year beyond the 120-day mark that plaintiff was required to meet under 4I. This court found waiver in the Dugan case and applied very fact-specific circumstances to find that waiver pursuant to NRCP 1, NRCP 4, and NRCP 12. This court looked at those fact-specific circumstances and said, well, in that case, in Dugan, the plaintiff was only 8 days late, served the complaint 128 days after the filing of the complaint. In that case, the defendant, by contrast, was 351 days late in objecting. And in that case, the defendant had actual notice 128 days after the filing of the complaint. So the defendant waited over, well, actually nearly a year to object to the timeliness of service. And in that case, this court said, well, we have to look at Rule 1, which says we need to interpret the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure pursuant to a speedy, just, and inexpensive determination of every action.
What was your time frame between the initial answer and the motion to amend the answer, if you know?
Walmart answered on the same day it received the 3-day notice of intent to take default, which was October 9th, 2008. Pursuant to 15A, Walmart would have had to amend as a matter of course within 20 days of the 9th, so on October 29th. Walmart filed motion for leave to amend on December 24th, 2008. So by contrast, if you look at the facts in Dugan and look at this court's rationale in Dugan, this court could not possibly find that Walmart waived the objection as to timeliness of service. That would result in a gross miscarriage of justice here, where Walmart, at the time it served with the 3-day notice of intent to take default, is relying on plaintiff's false affidavit of service, which had been filed within the 120-day time limit.
Counsel, when you talk about fairness and such, it's indicated in the factual background that even though service may not have been on the resident agent, they did serve a man at Walmart, They additionally, by letter, attempted to communicate with, I guess it was the insurance carrier or your self-insured. So Walmart was put on some kind of notice. So how is that totally unfair?
Well, Your Honor, to address that, Emmy Silva, the person to whom Sandoval sent some kind of correspondence supposedly after the filing of the complaint, no longer worked for the carrier at that time. And in fact, the last correspondence between the carrier...
Well, whether they worked for the carrier or not, wouldn't it have gone to the carrier? But you're giving me a litany that sounds to me as if Walmart knew what was going on.
Absolutely not. Walmart's first notice of the lawsuit was October 8th, 2008, when it was faxed over the notice of three-day intent to take default.
So their manager just received a document, some legal document, didn't take it to a higher-up, just crumbled it up and threw it away.
Well, whether he crumbled it up or threw it away, he didn't do anything with it and had no legal obligation to do so. Under the law, under NRS 40.020...
I understand that, counsel. I'm just looking at, you brought that wonderful word out, fairness. So I'm playing with it at this point.
Absolutely, and fairness is what is contemplated by NRS 40.020. Walmart is a corporation with over 900,000...
Can those facts be considered as to looking at Trimmer factors?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I do think Scrimmer does indeed need to be revisited because the court there in Scrimmer was looking at a practical flexibility approach to 4I and its dismissal authorization or mandate. But since the 2004 amendment, a district court reviewing under 4I doesn't have the same level of discretion. And in fact, as opposed to the holding in Scrimmer, which says there is no automatic sanction for failure to meet the 120-day mark, I would say post-2004, the amendment, the drafters, the advisory committee, indeed intends that there be an automatic sanction for failure to meet the 120-day mark in filing the service, the affidavit of service, or in completing service, unless there is a motion for an extension of time filed within the period, the 120-day period, and there is good cause shown.
How do we balance that position with the position counsel has advocated and Nevada has long stood for, and that is trying things on their merit?
Well, I think that's where, Your Honor, it is important to look at the waiver found in Dugan contrasted with the facts of this case. Here, Walmart's first notice of the lawsuit is October 8th, 2008. First actual notice. Under all the prior cases, when you look at actual notice, it's when Walmart is first, or when the defendant is first saying, look, I recognize there's a complaint out there. And in Dugan, the court is actually looking to legal authority to find waiver, looking to the federal cases that were applicable at that time. And it did so because at that time, FRCP Rule 4J was almost identical to NRCP 4I. Well, now we know, of course, that since the 2004 amendment, Rule 4I in Nevada is far more stringent than the federal corollary. And in fact, in Nevada, the district court does not have the discretion to grant an extension of time absent a showing of good cause, whereas now the federal corollary 4M does allow the district court that discretion. Moreover, in the amendment, the 2004 amendment, the advisory committee now notes that the district court must take into consideration a plaintiff or a party's failure to make that motion within the 120-day period and take it into determination in its consideration as to whether good cause is shown. So here, those
federal... Do we have a good cause factor for not making that motion within the 120 days?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Do we have a good cause application also as the failure of not making the motion within the 120 days?
I didn't catch the first part of Your Honor.
The first part is whether we have good cause that's applicable to filing that motion after the 120 days.
Absolutely not. In the transcript on the motion for enlargement of time, counsel acknowledged And in fact, I can quote for you, referring to the failure to serve, in the transcript, counsel says, quote, "I can't explain it. There was a lack of control in the office on how that was done," end quote. On that, the court found that Sandoval's attorney knew and should have known how to effect service per NRS 40.020. Just as Your Honor brought up earlier in appellant's argument, the attorney is charged with knowing NRS 40.020. And also there, the court found that apparently every effort was made to communicate with everybody but the resident agent, and that was insufficient to demonstrate good cause. Nothing in Sandoval's briefing or argument demonstrated good cause as defined by the Scrimmer factors.
Counsel, your answering to questions by Justice Douglas raises an interesting point in light of the amendment to 4I, which now compels the court to take the failure to file the motion within the 120-day period into consideration in determining whether good cause has been shown to support the extension. I think one of the things Justice Douglas's question asked is whether a party can still file a motion beyond the 120-day period and demonstrate good cause for the extension. And if so, should some of the Scrimmer factors be used in making that determination?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that the amendment to 4I specifically prohibits or prescribes filing the motion beyond the 120-day mark, but it does state that the court, the reviewing court, must take it into account in determining whether good cause is shown. And implied in that, I would certainly say the advisory committee intends that a failure to do so must count against a showing of good cause. So I would say there's no explicit mandate in 4I that it has to be done within the 120-day period, but it indeed counts against the showing of good cause if not done so.
So as a follow-up, would some of the factors enunciated in the Scrimmer case be used by a trial judge who's approaching this under the new 4I to determine whether or not the late filing of the motion should be excused?
I do think, Your Honor, that after the amendment to 4I, some of the Scrimmer factors are applicable. But because Scrimmer had the specific holding that practical flexibility is necessary given the discretion in 4I, and now since the amendment, there is much less discretion and more specific mandates and more direction as to how the good cause determination must be made, I think given that, only some of the Scrimmer factors must be looked at and must be looked at secondarily to whether the statute, or rather the rule on its face, is even complied with.
Do you have an example of the 10 Scrimmer factors where one would not be considered or should not be considered, and maybe one would be?
Well, for example, the sixth factor, the party's good faith attempts to settle during the 120-day period, that doesn't seem to be demonstrative of good cause because the mandate is in the rule regardless of whether ongoing settlement negotiations are occurring. And just as in Dugan, if settlement negotiations are occurring, the parties can negotiate an extension of time in which to file a responsive pleading. I think also that number four, the factor regarding difficulties encountered by counsel, that would be subsumed in number one, which is difficulty locating the defendant. But certainly whereas here the attorney is claiming that they somehow had difficulty serving per NRS 40.020, serving a corporate defendant, when the rule could not be clear as to how to do so, I don't think that the new 4I allows the court to say, okay, you hadn't figured it out, you ignored the statute, fine, it was difficult for you, we'll grant relief. I certainly don't think it's a fair reading of 4I to say that that difficulty encountered by counsel should warrant good cause.
Does the three-day notice strengthen your argument, the fact that you got a three-day notice?
Absolutely. Because in the Dugan case and all of the federal cases on which Dugan relies, they're looking at Rule 12, and Rule 12 provides for waiver if the motion to dismiss is not filed as a pre-pleading motion or if the amendment is not made as a matter of course. Both of those things, both of those options, have 20 days contemplated in them. Here, Walmart had one day. Walmart was given actual notice of the lawsuit on October 8, 2008. Walmart filed its answer on October 9, 2008. It would be manifestly unfair to say that Walmart necessarily had to investigate the missteps in service, that Walmart had to presume that the affidavit of service filed in the 120-day period was false, was inaccurate.
That's because of the three-day notice.
Exactly. It only had one day. And at that point, Walmart risks default. None of the cases on which Dugan relies, none of the federal cases, are speaking to waiver in the context.
Counsel, there's a Third Circuit case, though, that goes the other way as to this particular point that you're making. Do you have any comment on that? That's the Konsberg case out of the Third Circuit where if you don't properly assert it in your answer, you've waived it.
I certainly understand, Your Honor, that it may be waived. Under this court's rationale in finding waiver under Dugan, those facts and that rationale as applied to the facts.
I understand Dugan very well, but you were asserting that federal authority also agreed with you, and I said there's also some other federal authority that goes the other way. Do you have any comment about that?
I would say it's distinguishable in that there was not a one-day time frame in which to file the motion to dismiss. And here, that one-day time frame is what's critical. Walmart has relied on the affidavit of service that was filed within the 120-day time period and has every reason to believe it's accurate, every reason to believe it's not a false affidavit. And so Walmart relies on that in filing its answer and wouldn't have a basis to submit an objection as to timeliness of service.
Two other quick questions. The motion to amend the answer was unopposed.
That's right.
And there was no discussion of the waiver issue in the district court?
No, because it was unopposed, the court, after appearance by counsel, merely found that under 15A, justice required the amendment, and it was granted.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Griffith, you've got 5 minutes in rebuttal.
The thing I'd like the court to consider also is when Walmart says that they got this three-day notice of intent to take a default and then had to rush down and file their answer. If they had to get a copy of the complaint. How can they answer a complaint unless they have a copy of it? At the time, you could easily go online, print down a copy of the complaint, print down a copy of the then filed, long filed, proof of service. They could have examined those things. This panic to worry about, are we going to take a default against them? Relief from defaults is very wisely and easily granted in this state. Again, it reflects that public policy. We want to decide these cases on the merits.
Mr. Griffith, I guess my concern in hearing the arguments is the point Justice Douglas just made. It looks like you had a decent argument on the waiver. I mean, you could have raised, because they didn't do it in their, they filed their answer, they didn't raise it, time lapsed, and they moved to amend the answer. It was granted where they raised the issue of this failure to serve on time. But if it's not opposed anywhere in district court that we can see from the record, so how do we deal with that?
I recognize that, and I can't explain that. There is that question. Walmart makes a lot of arguments about diligence on behalf of the plaintiff. Perhaps there's an argument on diligence on behalf of the defendant. It would have been easy for them to, again, call and get a stipulation for extra time to file the answer. That's fine. I'm sure that would have been granted. They could have looked at this case a little bit closer. they could have taken the extra time it would take to actually look at that service and then, you know, prepare that in their formal first answer.
Well, I realize you weren't the attorney in district court, but the problem is none of that was done. So we have this record here where it wasn't raised, and we can't consider things first time on appeal.
Correct. So. Correct. And I can't explain that. That was not my involvement in the case. I was not involved at that time.
Right.
Anything else?
It's just that, yeah, my basic point is I don't think Walmart can claim that they've been seriously injured by this, because it would have been very, they didn't have to go out and do a panic answer. They just didn't have to do that. There's many ways for them to have dealt with that, and I cannot explain why they did not. The issue of waiver didn't come up in the underlying motion unless the specific reason for filing the complaint did not include, or filing the amended answer did not include, the fact they needed to add this objection to the error in service of process. Usually when I go and file an amended answer or an amended complaint, I actually prepare that and explain what amendments I need to bring in. I don't believe that was done in this case.
But counsel, we're sitting here and we're trying to balance this trial on the merits you put forth in adherence to the rule that counsel and Walmart's put forth, and a lack of showing of, so to speak, good faith to give you that opportunity. How do we get there?
Well, I think our best argument is long-standing professional process service made a mistake. And could we be held responsible for that? I suppose if it is a requirement that we have to specifically give instructions to a professional process server on how to serve a defendant.
And that would apply also to your failure to reply to the motion that was filed?
The motion to file the amended answer?
You didn't oppose that either?
Yes. That would be the... And again, when the proof of service came back, I suppose it has to be, and I do this, I religiously review that, having fought many of these fights before in the lower courts, having dealt with that. I will send those affidavits back to those process servers and say, no, you also have to have this in. But that didn't happen in this case.
Do you have an example of a situation in which, under your view of Rule 4I, the district court could properly, without abusing its discretion, say you blew the deadline, you don't have good cause, and your complaint's dismissed? To me, this fact pattern seems as extreme as you could get. If we were to find the court abused its discretion here, there would be very little left of that rule. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, the new Rule 4I really does establish, I think, a pretty high standard on this good cause. And it is a discretionary standard for the court, and the only good cause that we could rely on was the fact that we relied on a professional process server who made a mistake.
Thank you.
Colleagues, any other questions? All right. Thank both of you for your arguments today. Justice Pickering and I are off the next case, so we're going to take a brief recess and reconstitute the court, and we will be back. This matter stands submitted.
All rise.